I first started being invited to be a speaker, long before podcasts were a thing, I was just excited to share my stories. Having an online store was the furthest thing from my mind. But now I'm selling some of my favorite things online, and it is so easy. And that is because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform and helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. What I love about Shopify is no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. So sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/fortheLove, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/fortheLove now to grow your business. shopify.com/fortheLove.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Hey, everyone. Jen Hatmaker here, your host of the For the Love podcast. Woo! Welcome to the show. I'm like exhaling because not 45 seconds ago, I just finished this interview. I feel like I could just run around the block. So we are wrapping up a series called For the Love of Black Trailblazers. It's been amazing. We had Asia Wilson in, absolutely a superstar, two-time WNBA champion, like phenomenal interview. We had Jerry Merritt, Tyler's mom, who has just risen through the ranks of such a powerful position in the city of Vegas. And these women are incredible. They have broken barriers. They have opened doors. It's been a thrill to hear their stories and to celebrate them. And you guys, our final guest to wrap up this amazing series is literally a powerhouse. She is a powerhouse in her field, but also in the world. She's a brilliant political analyst. She shares her insights and interviews with us every night as a reliable and trustworthy guide through stories and, well, hell, the all too common political satire that's playing out in our democracy literally every single day. And she holds our leaders' feet to the fire, and she helps us make sense of the information overload. And I am telling you, wait till you hear this conversation today. I was like drinking through a fire hose. Guys, get ready to enjoy today the absolutely incredible Joy Reid. Now, you know Joy, but for those of you who need a refresher, Joy Reid, she's an MSNBC political analyst, and she's the host of The Readout, which airs weeknights on MSNBC. And she holds the title as the first Black woman to anchor a cable primetime news show. It's just a really big deal. On her way to this space, she hosted previously the weekend program AM Joy, the Daily News Show, the Reid Report. And listen, she's got the goods. She's got the credentials. Joy is a Harvard grad with a degree in visual and environmental studies, concentration in documentary film. She's a Knight Center for Advanced Journalism Fellow. She was the press secretary for the voter registration and mobilization entity, America Coming Together. She worked on the Florida branch of the Obama campaign. And her political writing prowess landed her columns and articles everywhere. New York Times, New Republic, Guardian, Daily Beast, New York, all of them, just all of them, really. She wrote a New York Times bestselling book called The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story. And she has a new book coming out that we're going to get into in just a moment. And so this is to say nothing of her wall of awards. She has received nominations and awards for her media work from the NAACP, the Emmys, the Women's Media Center, National Action Network, and GLAAD. She is so smart. She's so smart. This conversation is packed. I mean, I ask her everything. I ask her about immigration. I ask her about reproductive rights. I ask her her prediction for the election this year. I ask her what she thinks is on the line. I mean, it is all in here. She is so brilliant, so knowledgeable. I just sat here hanging onto my desk the whole time, like just to stay with her. This is a smart conversation, interesting, important, and even hopeful. And so, gosh, I'm delighted to bring you this conversation with the absolutely wonderful Joy Reid. Joy, welcome to the show. I'm just delighted to have you here.
Jen, it is so good to be here.
Thank you. I have respected you and admired you for a really long time. It's such a strange time to be alive. It is such a strange time to be an American. I find myself just absolutely scanning the horizon for trustworthy voices of reason, which used to feel like they were abundant. And now it's like, where did they go? And you're one of them. And it's so profoundly, I don't know if this is quite the right word, but comforting to have someone with such a level-headed, clear assessment of the state of things at the helm. I'm like, maybe we're going to make it. Joy's here.
You know what? We've got to make it, right? I mean, the alternative is... It's just unthinkable. And the thing is, I think because I understand that there are ways in which we could not make it. You know, my parents both come from countries that, you know, have had challenges with democracy, to put it mildly. And so it's not guaranteed, right? So we'll make it if we work for it.
That's right. Every sort of world power and stable country thinks they're impervious until they're not.
That's correct.
Yep. History is a mirror.
And we were just both talking, we've both been to Cuba. And I'll tell you, the thing about Cuba that is so sort of, it's like, it's a beautiful and horrible country at the same time. But what you realize is when you see the people there who are so friendly and so kind, they've also adapted to having no rights, to having no ability to speak against their government, to having no freedom. And human beings are so adaptable, they will thrive and live in any condition. So you see kids skipping through the streets like regular kids. No one there is like looking terrified, like they have adapted to autocracy. And so the challenge is, I see us slowly adapting to things like political violence, to just normalizing things that seemed unthinkable. We're adapting to like a 1930s Europe paradigm. And you're seeing it in real time. The Germans adapted to Nazism, and we are adapting to fascism. And so that's what scares me, is that people, it's like a slow boil. It's like a frog in a pot. And by the time you realize you're boiling, it's too late.
You're exactly right. I was just having this conversation yesterday with a really interesting friend of mine, and we were talking about what's going on around reproductive rights right now and all those that are being walked back and sort of really stolen out of the hands of women. And I was asking her, I said, where are the adults? Like, how is this happening? Why aren't the adults in the room standing up saying, this is not acceptable in America? But it's what you're saying. It's one little piece of legislation at a time. It's incremental until all of a sudden here we are.
And here we, you know, it's funny. I was in Texas and this was, I want to say, 2 years ago, we were doing a live show from Fort Worth. And at the end of the show, you know, you do all the selfies and everybody's like, and then we're walking back to the car and this woman comes up to me, tall, blonde, pretty. She kind of has the, you know, she could be in like a beauty pageant kind of look. And so because she has that kind of Texas beauty pageant look, I'm thinking, oh, here comes the conservative that's going to yell at me, right? Because, you know, we've gone through a whole day and I haven't had a Texas, you know, conservative yell at me.
Yeah, you would do.
All the liberals, all the little liberals ran to our little set. And so all the little liberals in Texas were on our set. And I'm thinking, I'm finally going to now have the conservative, because she didn't come up to me during the broadcast. She waited till I'm walking to the talk. So I'm bracing myself for, okay, she's going to tell me I'm the worst person in the world. Instead, this woman, this sort of beauty queen looking woman, starts crying. And she says, I'm so scared. I don't know what I'm going to do. They're taking all our reproductive rights away. I have three daughters. They're preteens. I don't know where else to go. I live here. I grew up here. My family goes back. This is where I'm from. I don't know what to do. And she's literally crying. I didn't know what else to do. I gave her a hug. I said, it's going to be okay. Since I've left there, Texas women have lost more rights, and five of them have sued because they almost died because they swept away their right to their own bodies, their right over their own bodies. And yet I was there before the election in which the governor of Texas and the entire administration was reelected easily.
That's right, reelected. Easily. Yep.
And so Texas women had the chance to punish them for the rights they'd already taken away and to prevent them from taking more. They didn't do it. You go to Georgia, where they have a 6-week abortion ban, which was in place before the opportunity to elect or not reelect Brian Kemp. And though he had taken not just the rights of women over their bodies, but also the right to vote, and signed the legislation to take away the right to vote in front of a portrait of a plantation, they still reelected him.
That is so frustratingly predictable. I'm in Austin here, of course. And so we're a little bit more of a progressive outpost in the state, but watching us elect the same state leadership election after election to our own detriment, against our best interest. And we're going to talk in a minute too. We've got, of course, a heavy portion of like the Texas concern is the border. Although our voting numbers aren't white as stark as they once were, as our metro cities continue to grow largely from people who are coming into Texas from another place. But it's scary. It really is. Like, it's scary and it's frustrating. And the stranglehold that the GOP has on its base, that they are unwilling to see themselves as pawns or even imagine what would this mean just for my daughter.
Absolutely. I mean, and the thing is that the irony is, women outvote men in every demographic, white, Black, Latino, Asian American. Women vote more than men, period, in America. Imagine a world in which women across demographics all voted together. There would be no way we would lose another right. We would have gun reform right now. It's a 70-30 issue, gun reform. Even in Texas, even gun owners agree that there should be some restrictions because the largest massacres have taken place in Texas. Texas gun owners agree. They can't get it passed even in Texas where they want it. And people will use guns and the fear of somehow some mythical confiscation at a mass level of guns as an excuse to strip themselves of rights over their own bodies, to strip themselves of the right to vote. And you can't set aside suppression. Texas is one of the most suppressive states in terms of the right to vote. They artificially suppress the Latino vote and they suppress the county, Hamilton County, that contains Houston, artificially to perpetuate their own power. But we have to figure out ways to thwart that. It's been done in the past when it was even worse and when the right to vote was even more inaccessible. Somehow, Americans of good conscience and who really care about democracy have found a way to thwart it before. We should be able to find a way with all of our modern conveniences and the internet and all of our connectivity. If we can't defeat fascism now, then we can't defeat it.
I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that because you have such a national perspective and you're a journalist, so you're paying attention even closer than most. In your opinion, being a student of history, having seen cycles of injustice ultimately become overturned in America. What are your thoughts? What would it look like to thwart this mountain? I'm curious, do you have ideas? Is history our teacher?
I think it is. You know, there have been three, to me, instances of substantial forward progress. You know, American history is kind of like a coil. It rolls forward and then it rolls back and it rolls forward. But as it's rolling forward and backward, it's slowly advancing. So we're advancing toward the multiracial democracy that the founders never intended, but built accidentally anyway, right? By importing Black enslaved people, they built a multiracial democracy by default. And by taking over a country that had an indigenous population, you've now got three. And then by constantly trying to replace Black slave labor with brown labor, with Asian labor, with Puerto Ricans, with taking Hawaii, they keep adding people of color. And so you've now built a multiracial democracy, whether you want it to or not, and you can't forever deny those non-white people their rights, because they see what you have. They see that you have the right to vote. They see that you have the right to free speech. And they say, well, I live here. I'm a citizen. I fight in the same wars as you. I pay the same taxes as you. I want the same rights. And you just really can't deny it. And so by default, we have to be a multiracial democracy because of the way we're built. So you set it that aside. So to me, there have been three instances where we've seen that forward coil. The first is Reconstruction. You have the worst point in American history, meaning just after enslavement, the most evil enterprise, because it wasn't regular slavery like they had in Africa or in Rome. It was chattel slavery, meaning slavery where you breed people like a cow. So cattle slavery, you may as well take the H out, right? It's cattle slavery, where you take these humans and treat them as cattle. After that, those former cattle immediately sign on to the constitutional idea of voting, of participation, of being a part of civic society. Women can't vote, of course, because they hated Black people, but they hated women more.
That's right. That's right.
Women couldn't vote.
There is a pecking order.
There's a pecking order, and women are, you know, at the bottom. But they let the men vote. Initially, you know, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, 13th, 14th, and 15th empower Black men to vote. So Reconstruction is actually really successful. We have 12 years in which a Black and tan coalition of white and Black men and the women who are behind the scenes working as well and working on trying to get women the right to vote have this incredible experiment in places like South Carolina. South Carolina is the first place we had free public school because of the Black and tan. It was Black schools, which were free public schools. It creates a system that then perpetuates nationwide. The first place we have affordable health care is in Mound Bayou, Mississippi, where a Black man named T.R.M. Howard creates the first affordable health care. The experiment in Reconstruction actually worked. Then the angry people roll that all back with Redemption. The second time was, you know, during the time when women got the right to vote, the early 20th century, when you had this huge upheaval. But in those decades, we got things like labor laws, which ended child labor. We got women the right to vote. It didn't apply to Black women initially. It took a little time to get that to go. We got things like an 8-hour workday, union rights. We had a revolution in that first third of the America that we called it the American century for a reason. You had this incredible leap forward economically for people. You had Asian Americans who were excluded, allowed to come in to integrate formally into the country. We have this like churning forward. And then, of course, that gets rolled back too. And then you have the civil rights movement being the third, which was a real revolution and an heroic era in our history in the 1960s, where we pushed forward even more. And then that goes into women getting our rights over reproduction in the 1970s. We've done it before. We just keep letting it roll back. You could throw Obama winning too as the fourth.
I will. It's actually strangely comforting to hear you say that, that our country has stood on the cusp of disastrous policy and practice and found a way forward. It always feels so monumental when it's our generation. You know, because this is our watch, but you are right. I mean, my mom, one generation removed in Kansas, was a sophomore in high school when her high school was integrated. I mean, that wasn't long ago. It really wasn't. And so it is possible, and the will of the people have found a way before, and they can do it again.
Summer is coming, and so is my much anticipated meet camp.
The past few summers, I've been taking some time to travel alone. It's time for me to read and explore small towns and meet new people. And this year, I'm thrilled to have a new way to plan my adventures. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there, no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in. For my trip, I'm considering a wine tasting event or maybe a sunset sail. I've been reading real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already done the activities. Viator also offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if your plans change. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Guys, it's already allergy season in Texas. My yard is in full bloom and all the things are in the air. So I decided allergies will not win this year. So I tried Astapro. It has improved my nasal allergy symptoms and it's faster, bro. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. So get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go, you guys, today. Astepro allergy.com. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies. Astapro and go. I love having you here because your brilliant mind just spouts. You just know it all. We so respect and admire our journalists, and you bring us the stories, but we never get to know. You're neutral. You're supposed to be. That's your job. Well done. But we don't often get to know you. We don't get to have a conversation with our journalists as a human person. And so I'd like to hear more about you. I'd like to hear about your family. I'd like to hear about what kind of kid you were, because of course now we see you here as an outrageously successful person. I mean, by all accounts, you have broken so many ceilings and your accolades just line the walls. Were you like this? Were you like this as a kid? Or were your parents like, of course, or was this surprising?
I was exactly like this, except with Coke bottle glasses. Just picture me with Coke bottle glasses. Same. Right? So, I mean, and then, you know, what's so sad is that glasses got cute, like in the, like 10 years ago. And I'm like, oh, now glasses
are
cute.
I'm furious.
And now I got the eye surgery and now I can't wear glasses. So I'm like, oh, that's real cute. That
exactly
glasses
me.
Are adorable.
I'm like, where were those in second grade?
Where were those in second grade when I had the Coke bottles on?
Thank you.
So basically, I'm a middle child. So you can see I'm an extroverted middle child. I'm a very typical middle child Sagittarius girl. Grew up in Denver, Colorado. I was born in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, New York. We moved, my big sister, my mom and I, my parents were divorced. They moved to Denver, Colorado. That's where my brother was born. And we grew up there in the 70s. You know, I was a 70s child and an 80s high school student. My mom immigrated to the United States from Guyana. My father was from the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, but they split. So he was really in the Congo as I was growing up. He was a phone father, not much involved in our lives other than that. And so we were just like a team of four. It was my mom, who was this adventurous, incredible woman who was a nutritionist and dietitian. And she did all of these projects where we were constantly on the road. We would do road trips. We were the road trip family. And we drove really all over the United States because she was working on a book or she's working on a research thing, or she was just curious to see San Francisco or visit a friend. And we were portable. We didn't have a lot of money. So we had to do it all in the car. We didn't have money to fly. So we just kind of all over the country. And I grew up with this adventurous spirit because of my mom. And because we were West Indian kids, we kind of declared as young kids, we were going to be a doctor, a lawyer, and an architect. And so I was supposed to be the doctor of the three, but my mom passed away when I was 17. And that kind of blew up my plans. So I arrived at Harvard, went through a period of really deep depression and discombobulation, took a year off, moved to New York, lived with my Auntie Dolly for a while, but she was hyper religious. Now, I grew up Methodist. She was evangelical. And so I wasn't a 4-hour church. And I wasn't 4 days a week a 4-hour church.
Get excited.
Get excited. So I lived with her for about a little less than a year. And then I moved out, lived on my own. And I moved into Fort Greene, which now is basically the Upper East Side. It's very gentrified. But at the time, it was Spike Lee's playhouse. Spike lived down the street from me. There were films being filmed on our street all the time. It was Brooklyn Bohemia, basically, Black Bohemia of that era. And so that sent me back to school with a completely different mindset. I switched my major to documentary film, what they call visual environmental studies at Harvard, and just decided I wanted to be Spike Lee. But I wound up not being Spike Lee. I wound up in the news instead, because I always loved news. I was a news junkie growing up. Oh, I always loved it. I was addicted to it. I got addicted during the Iran hostage crisis, just aging myself.
Yeah.
And my mom would let me sit up and watch it because she loved news too. So I would sit and watch the news. I would watch the Sunday shows, Meet the Press. I just watched it all. And it was just all in. And so when, you know, long story short, we had an opportunity, my then boyfriend, Jason, and I, who's now my husband, we were pregnant for the second time and we needed a house and we decided to move to Florida. And I needed a job. And I wrote to the Fox affiliate saying, I really love your entertainment show at night. Would you hire me, please?
With Crazy. And when you say right, you mean right, like on paper.
Yeah, I wrote a paper. I wrote a paper. Yeah, I wrote a paper letter.
There's no slide into someone's DMs back there. Like,
there was no DMs.
Hustle.
Yes. Hunty, we had to write letters.
That's right.
So I wrote a letter. And I got hired and I wound up swept into the news business, worked for NBC News. And I quit NBC News because I was very against the Iraq war and I didn't like the way the news media was sort of jingoistically covering it. So that put me in campaign world. I went and worked for this George Soros funded PAC that was trying to defeat George W. Bush. We lost. And then some of those same people, I had like an interstitial in talk radio. And then some of my friends were working on the Obama campaign from the 2004 campaign. They got me on and the rest is history. I ended up being a pundit after Obama won. Got swept back into NBC running something called thegrio.com, which is actually, I think, where I met our mutual friend, Tyler Merritt.
Yeah.
I think that's where I met Tyler when I was at The Grio. And then I ended up just doing a lot of TV at MSNBC and getting a couple shows. And 3 shows later, here I am.
I mean, and let's not undersell it. You hold the title of the first Black woman to anchor a cable primetime news show. It's not small. It's just, I have goosebumps. I mean, it's profound. It's outrageous that you're the first in my generation. That's outrageous. But you've plowed up a field that was inhospitable. I'd like to hear about how that feels. And then I'd also like to hear how you feel about changing the media landscape so that more Black women are not only like represented, but in charge.
Yeah.
And what that looks like for you.
Absolutely. No, it is profound. I mean, because I grew up, the only person who looked like me on TV was Gwen Ifill. And I revere Gwen Ifill. I remember one in 2015, very quick side story. I saw Gwen Ifill across the street. I was in town when I was doing my weekend show, AM Joy, on 2015. We go down to Selma for the bridge crossing is going to be actually soon, the commemoration. And I see Gwen Ifill across the street. So of course I have no tact. So I see her like, oh my God, and I ran across the street and I ran and I threw my arms up and I said, Gwen, I'm in my just I was a little kid. I'm such a kid. And she opened her arms and I threw myself on her. I threw myself like Gwen Ifill. But she hugged me and she was so sweet. And she was like, oh honey, it's so great to meet you. And she was like, I'm proud of you, all the work you're doing. And she pretended like she knew who I was, which is amazing. So I revered Gwen Ifill. That was the only person like that looked like me, right? And so I think for me, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm the person that looks like the young Black girls who come up to me like that. You know what I mean? And it makes me feel very proud because I can represent, you know? And you really can only be what you can see. I think you can relate to that. As a woman, you have to see it in order, you know, there were no women airline pilots or women college professors. All of the business moguls were men. All of the CEOs. When you think CEO, you think white guy. You think, you know, but we're as women breaking into spaces where we're not supposed to be, you know? I mean, I even think of Miss Merle, yeah, I revere Merle Evers. She's an icon to me. And she lived in a space that no one was in. There weren't a lot of chairwomen of the NAACP who were women. There was literally two. So it's like you, as a woman of color, you feel a profound sense of responsibility occupying these spaces where no one has occupied before. But what I try to do just in my work, and whenever I have a show, I'm very proud of the fact I'm usually the show with the most diverse team. Melissa Harris Perry was before me because she was very much about that life, about, you know, always looking for, are there more women? Are there more Black women? Are there more Asian Americans, et cetera? Do we have a little bit of everyone represented on our team? And my team does. The team that produces the readout, we have, you name the demographic, we've got it. Age-wise, gender-wise, sexual orientation-wise, you know, we've got, we try to have someone from every community because that way when we're having our show meeting, we're really not missing much, you know? I feel like the goal is when you get in the door, just prop it open and let more people in, because diversity and equity and inclusion, it's become a bad word, but it actually just means making America more what it was meant to be.
That's right. And frankly, even if you have a heart of stone, if you have not a good molecule in your body, it's just good for America. It's good for the GDP. It's good for healthcare. It's good for public schools. The whole harbor rises. So if you only care about the bottom line, that's still the right path.
You know, it's so hilarious. It's so funny that you say that, because I, every time there's like a right-wing boycott attempt, like when they were mad about the Little Mermaid, I'm like, y'all do math, right? America is becoming a majority non-white country. And if you are under 15 years old, your age group and under is already majority non-white. These media companies do not care about morality. They want to sell those dollies. And if they're making a dolly that's brown, they're going to sell more dollies because all those little brown girls want the dolly that looks like them. Kids have the internet. They have Snapchat and they have Instagram. And you know what they do on that? They make up their face. They make everything. They're self-reflective. People want to play with a doll that looks like them.
This is just business.
When I was a little kid, we would play baby dolly with a little white dolly because it was no, so it looked real odd. It's like, this is my baby. No, it's not.
That's right.
That's not. Now you can have a baby that looks like you. Kids love it. And so they want to sell the Little Mermaid dolly. So they made the mermaid look like the kids. This is not rocket science, guys. It's not wokeness. It's business.
It is. It's business. And we've got plenty of data to support that, not just from America, but from developing countries. When they empower women and girls, when women and girls are safe, free of violence and educated, the entire GDP just lifts and lifts and lifts and lifts. So
if you take countries where abortion is illegal, their GDP is artificially reduced. If you can control your reproduction as a woman, it increases literally your country's GDP. And we're going the opposite direction in America. Imagine that, the most powerful country in the world, the most powerful economy in the world, is trying to stunt itself by trying to take half the population and incarcerate them in the stirrups. Make it make sense.
Oh, it puts a rock in my stomach. And don't get me started on the whole sham that it's for the babies. It's just political theater. I mean, look at Alabama right now with the IVF stuff going on. Like, it's theater. This is theater. It was never, ever, ever, ever about unborn babies, ever. I mean, I don't understand. Make it make sense. This is so plain. It's so clear. This is about controlling women's bodies. It's about preserving the patriarchy and keeping a thumb on all the girls' heads. And I just don't understand it. I cannot understand how any living woman can sign on for it. I don't care who you adhere to, which political party you identify with. That matters not. Are you a woman? This should alarm you. Do you have a daughter? You should be running in the streets. I just don't get it. I don't get it. I can't make it make sense.
It makes no sense. And the thing is, you know, again, just having just been in St. Louis on this little book tour, what made me so sad, the hotel we were staying in, it looked out over this basically industrial wasteland. It was this old factory that was right outside the window where we could just see it from our window. And it was sort of, you could see steam coming out of it, but it looked decrepit. And you looked around it and you saw nothing but a wasteland, a sort of old corporate wasteland, you know what I mean? Industrial wasteland, I should say. And so rather than grow their economy and make Missouri better and make it economically powerful, I mean, look, they just had the Kansas City Chiefs try to have a march to celebrate their success in the Super Bowl, and it got shot up. In Missouri, it's easier to get a AR-15 than it is to raise your family, than it is to afford preschool, than it is to afford food. They're making it essentially a state full of warlords who can get as many guns as they want with no permit. How do you even get mental health care? How do you get physical health care? Can you even get Medicaid? Probably not. Do they get school lunch in school? I don't even know if they're funding it. This is a state that is so draconian, and it's not even the South. So we're just thinking it's not just the South, it's red states, period. They will not fund decent lives for their citizens. They will not fund food for their children, but they say that stopping abortion is about the children. Make it make That's sense.
Right. And it won't, because it's not about that. Tennessee just has done the same thing. They just denied millions of dollars for their summer food program for kids who are going to go hungry now. The born kids. Yeah.
So when you're unborn, they love you though.
Listen, they'll go to the mat. I'd like to hear your thoughts on immigration. You're obviously a daughter of immigrants. And so you have a very personal understanding of what it means to immigrate to America, what it means to build a life here. And of course, I'm Texan. And so this is constantly at the forefront of every sort of state conversation. And Biden and Trump both talking about immigration from very different angles. And so Biden was down in Brownsville, and which we kind of have a really interesting model that is working, and it has dignity inside of it, and it's humane. I'd like to hear your thoughts, because immigration and the border, it is an issue. It bears our attention. There is the need for like reform and better systems and better policies. So it's not a non-starter, but the demonization, of course, of people crossing the border is such a predictable trope and useful. It's become very, very useful. So your thoughts, your solutions, if you have ideas, what do you see? What do you know that's different than the sort of national narrative, at least on one half, spun constantly?
I mean, we were in El Paso a few years ago on my old show. And it's interesting when you actually are in El Paso and places that are border communities, as you're saying, there's a whole thriving economy. There are kids who live in Mexico and go to school in Texas and vice versa. People walk back and forth. There are a lot of American seniors who can't afford drugs to buy their prescriptions, and they stay in El Paso for a few days and then they go to Mexico and buy their prescriptions because it's just cheaper. So there's a whole real economy that passes back and forth that people that are in places like New York screaming about it or in Indiana screaming about it, they don't even see. So my mother came here to this country in 1960. It took her 16 years to get her citizenship. The first time she was able to vote was in the 1976 election when she finally became a citizen. She signed the paperwork because you have family immigration, this chain migration, which Melania Trump, by the way, used to get in and get her mom and her sister in, chain migration. My mom used it as well for her nephews and nieces. And so most of my family who are in this country, my mother helped them get through once she got her paperwork through. But the process is very onerous and takes forever. And my mother came here as somebody with a college degree, working on a master's degree and ultimately a PhD. She was a contributor economically. She never had fewer than two jobs. This was a working person who was constantly struggling to say, you know, to make money, but she was not on this quote unquote system. So immigrants are mostly like my mom. Those immigrants who people are fighting hardest against, the people who are coming from Guatemala and coming from El Salvador, and by the way, also coming from China and Ukraine at this point, or trying to come in through Mexico, all they want to do is work. They are the hardest working people you will ever find in America. Absolutely. If you see a construction site, they're on it. If you see a field where they're picking vegetables and fruit, they're out there. They're the ones working 12-hour days for almost no money. You love these chicken sandwiches. Remember when Popeye's chicken sandwiches, that nobody could get a hold of, there were long lines outside of them? The chicken plucking plants that are located primarily in states like Mississippi, are literally full of migrant labor. And they are sometimes 14-year-olds who are cleaning the blood off the floor, doing the dangerous work of deboning those chickens so that everybody can have their sandwiches. This economy is built on the labor of those people. And if they weren't doing it, I promise you, you wouldn't do it. Because these are the dirtiest, most dangerous jobs in America. And they are done quietly behind the scenes by migrant labor. Why? Because America's economy was built on perfect capitalism, slavery. When slavery ended, there has been a race from the time of slavery on to replace that free labor with labor that's as cheap as possible. It's why we have Puerto Rico. We wanted those laborers. It's why we have so many Mexican laborers that, by the way, Ronald Reagan completely did amnesty for 2 million people in the 1980s. Because we have people here who we want desperately their labor. Because Black folks ain't doing it again. We've been in the field and we're not going back. White Americans ain't going in the field, period. Ain't done it, not do it. Asian Americans did their time building the railroads. They said, been there, done that. Yeah, they've moved on. And we keep trying to replace cheap labor. Now, America could change that by paying people living wages, but Americans don't want to do that. We love the cheap labor because we love the cheap chicken sandwiches.
I'm obsessed. My friend Chelsea was wearing the softest cashmere sweater in that perfect weight for spring. She told me it was under $50, made by a fantastic company named Quince. And I could shop for my laptop, which is my dream. So I immediately ordered the cashmere tee. Now I want it in every color. Quince offers staple pieces like Chelsea's Mongolian cashmere sweater, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, classic like 14 karat gold jewelry. You can upgrade your wardrobe with luxury essentials, but unbeatable prices. You guys, seriously, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And I know what you're thinking, but Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible practices and premium fabrics, which I love. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/hatmaker for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/hatmaker to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/hatmaker.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country. The kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Let's talk about your book. I told you before we started recording, I'm like, you just do not choose to live in the shallow waters. You just don't. Because you have recently written a book about Medgar Evers, civil rights activist, and his wife, Merle. And so I'd love to hear you talk about this. First of all, why? You've got everything at your fingertips that you may research and spend 2 or 3 years on and write about and immerse yourself in. And I'd love to know why this story rose to the top for you. And then also what you're hoping that this book accomplishes, what needle you want to move forward, what you hope your readers walk away with.
Well, you know, it is appropriate that I am here on For the Love because I wrote the book For the Love. I wrote the book because I kind of fell in love with Merle Evers Williams when I finally met her in person in 2018. This was on my previous show, AM Joy. We're out in California. We're doing the show. My guests for the E block, for the final block of the show, Maxine Waters, Representative Maxine Waters of California, and Miss Merle. Miss Merle shows up, and I had interviewed her remotely before, but I had never met her before. And again, she's an icon to me as somebody who's a nerd, loves civil rights as a story, as a thing to read about. So she comes in and she has this newspaper in her hand, and it's a newspaper interview that the New York Times did with me, calling me like something about the resistance or something like that. And so she has this paper and she says, "I want you to sign this paper for me." And I almost fainted.
I can't.
Because I'm like, okay, she knows who I am. And she has this newspaper. She's like, "Autograph this paper." And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to die." I love this woman. And she has this amazing voice. And she says, "I want you to autograph this paper." So I autographed the paper for her. And then we just started chatting. This is after the segment was over. And then we start off just talking about our families, talking about our lives. You know, I talked about my mom. I said, "I think you and my mom would have been best friends because they were around the same age." And then we start talking about Medgar. I don't know how we got on this subject, but she starts talking about this man like this was her little boyfriend that she just met. And she's so giddy in love with him.
That's
and I'm
so
like,
cute.
Ms. Murphy, Medgar Evers has been dead for almost 60 years. You're talking about him like a little schoolgirl. And she said, "Medgar Evers was the love of my life." Like that. And I said,
ma'am.
So, okay, ma'am. Yeah. So that conversation actually just stayed with me for years. Like I didn't actually start this book until like 2 years later, almost 3 years later. And I'm sitting with my book agent, Suzanne Gluck. Cheers to Suzanne. And Peter, who is my publisher, my awesome publisher, who is just awesome. We've done 3 books together. This is our third book that we've done together. So the 3 of us are like at lunch and they're like, "Well, what do you want to write about?" And I was like, "I don't know that I don't want to do another Trump book." I had just done a Trump book. It did really well. We got on the bestsellers. It's like, yay. But I was like, "I don't want to live in his head for another 2 years." I just was like, "I think I want to write a love story. I think I want to write like a civil rights love story. What would you guys think about this?" Like, it would be different because it would be different from what I normally do because I normally write about politics. But I love history. I think this would be an interesting story. I had been caught up because I had seen Queen and Slim, I think, by then. And I was obsessed with that story. And I was like, it's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet of the 60s. You know what I mean? It's tragic, but it's like a love story. And I think I kind of just sold it to them like at lunch. And they were like, okay. And so it was just a matter of if I could get the family to go along with it. Because, you know, Miss Merle has written 2 great autobiographies. She helped Manning Marable do her husband's papers. I didn't know if she wanted to go back and live through this assassination story again. So it was a matter of reaching out to both of the kids who are very protective of their mom and having these conversations. Would she be open to talking to me? Thank God they got a yes from her. And then we just kind of were off to the races. And it was 2 years of research. I had 2 research assistants from Howard University that worked on the genealogy and the background and finding everything we could find and sitting in the archives in Jackson, Mississippi, and finding every living person who lived on that block. Most of them still lived on the block, interestingly enough.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
It's such a stable community that most of the people who we wanted to interview still literally lived on Gine Street.
What do you know?
On the same street.
Wow. What was the most interesting thing you discovered? Like, what was the most fascinating interview you conducted or something you sort of peeled back and went, "Well, look at that."
Yeah. This one isn't like, it's not necessarily the most interesting thing, but I think the most interesting thing that I took from the book that I hadn't thought about, and you know, I covered Black Lives Matter. That was my book for years, for what, about 4 years. And it's a hard beat, right, to do. Dealing with the mothers of murdered children, you know, a lot of moms and some dads, just it's painful, but the children are gone. In this case, I interviewed the children, and you don't think about the fact that if you're a kid that lives on a street where a man who's like the fun dad on the block, who you know because he throws a football with you guys, he's the one who throws you in his car and takes you to the segregated, you know, drive-in theater to see movies, and you're all in the back of his car, and you know this guy, right? You may not know he's a civil rights leader, but you know him. And then he gets assassinated at home. The lifelong trauma of the kids who are now adults. That is the thing I wasn't prepared for. The conversations I had with people who are now adults, but who were kids at the time, stayed with me because it's like, wow, we don't think about that. It's not just the trauma to Miller Evers and Merle Evers' children, which was lifelong, it's lifelong, but all the kids on the block, this one young man, the Sweets, or a boy and a girl, they were a boy and a girl at the time, they're a man and woman now. And the Sweet kids are the ones who said that to me. They said, think about the trauma we all felt. We knew that not only had somebody died, now we're dealing with death, which we already have in the back of our minds as Black kids, because we know about lynchings. We hear about lynchings, but they're in Jackson in the city. So they hadn't seen a lynching. They read in Jet magazine about Emmett Till and seen that horrible picture. So they all knew lynchings happened in Mississippi. This one happened down the street. And for one of the young women who interviewed, it happened next door. And so we interviewed the daughter of the Evers neighbor who watched him pull himself through blood to try to get into his house. She's watching this as a 15-year-old girl. And her little sister, they're looking out the window. Literally, their bedroom faces the carport. So they see it. Can you imagine? These are the kind of things that our young men and women see in wartime. And it traumatizes them for the rest of their lives. Imagine just a kid on the block. So that's, I think, the thing that was the most profound for me.
Last question. And off you go off to your day. I'd like to hear your thoughts / prediction, if you will, for the election this year. You're such an insider. You see more and hear more than the average person. What are your thoughts? Do you have a prediction?
So I would say, and I'll tie just very quickly back to this book a little bit. The thing that I took away from it, my big, big takeaway, is that courage is contagious, right? When Medgar Evers died, the funeral was supposed to be this dignified march. They promised there wouldn't be any protests. But when the young people started to sing This Little Light of Mine, which was his favorite song, his favorite protest song, the police responded with barbarity and started beating these kids at the funeral. And Dr. King was whisked away and it was like a whole mess. But what that said was that these young people were unafraid. The killing Medgar Evers did not make them more afraid, it made them less afraid. I now transport us forward to Navalny. Alexei Navalny in Russia was buried today. But he was buried and the Russian government had held his body and not wanted to let it go. The family got the body back. They buried him today. The mourners at his funeral, like at the Medgar Evers funeral, protested.
I saw that.
Protested, which can get you killed or get you incarcerated, just like it could in 1960s Mississippi. Same in Russia of today, even more terrifying. Like, they're risking incarceration and joining Navalny's fate. But killing Navalny didn't make these Russians more afraid. It made them less afraid, right? And so I think what we just saw happen in the Supreme Court is that at least 5 members of the court, because that's what it would take to have them hear the case, decided that they would entertain the idea that the president of the United States maybe could take SEAL Team 6 and kill his political opponents, and that that would be fine because he would have total immunity from criminal prosecution forever, so long as he ever has been president of the United States. That's insane.
That's insane.
The fact that they're doing it and that they're going to hear this case, not now, but in more than a month from now, that they're going to delay and delay and delay it and then hear it with the husband of one of the insurrectionists sitting on the dais, Clarence Thomas, getting to decide whether his wife's advocacy for overthrowing the government was legitimate. It's all crazy. But what should happen for Americans is that the apostasy against the Constitution of our institutional supposed guardians, the Supreme Court, the Congress, the House of Representatives, all of them are apostates at this point. None of them believe in the Constitution. They believe in power. And they've decided that the power that they, that their power depends on Donald Trump being president again. It seems like that is a now joint conclusion of the Supreme Court's conservative majority, the House majority, and some senators, people like Lindsey Graham, who used to know better. Given that, those terrifying facts should make us not more afraid, but less afraid. Because what these people are doing are empowering us. What they're saying is, we're not going to save you. We're not going to help you. There is no cavalry. We are the cavalry. We have to be the cavalry. As Barack Obama loved to quote, we are the ones we've been waiting for. So we need to stop relying on the courts to save us. This is a Medgar Eversism. The courts can't save us, Mississippi. He didn't believe that. His bosses thought the courts will just let the Supreme Court do it. He was like, nope, we have to save ourselves. We have to save ourselves. And likewise today, we have to save ourselves. Now, we may not like the choices that we have, but life ain't about good choices. Life doesn't give you great choice. We don't always get a Barack Obama to vote for. We almost never do. In fact, we've gotten it once. Literally. So what you have to do right now is you have to think in holistic terms about how to save yourself. Because now this is about saving ourselves from autocracy and for women from incarceration in our states. Our wombs being the property of men who don't think much of us and don't think of money of much of our rights. We have to save ourselves, not just by voting for president, but by choosing the Senate in a different way, by choosing a different House of Representatives, by choosing different state legislatures, different governors. You need to start choosing not based on the party you're loyal to and the jersey you put on at age 18 when you became a Republican or a Democrat. You need to choose based on who's going to let you be free. You need to choose based on who's going to support your freedom. Your freedom is at stake now. And unfortunately, Democrats keep saying this is the most important election of our life. We keep saying it. And it's wrong to say that all the time because people feel like you're crying wolf. But y'all, I'm telling you, this time, it's real. This is it. This might be our last election. So this time you need to choose freedom, not your jersey. Take off that jersey. If you are a Republican, and I'm talking to your sisters, my sister, I'm talking to white women who still vote majority Republican. Take that jersey off. Forget the parties of the people in front of you and do a little research. People like to say, do your own research during COVID. Do a little research. Which of the candidates on that ballot believes in your freedom? And I mean up and down from school board, who believes in your freedom to decide what your children read? Who believes in your freedom over your body? Who believes in your freedom to vote? Who believes in your freedom? Vote your freedom, not your preference or who you like or who you'd prefer. Or which party is your jersey? You got to vote your freedom or none of us will have freedom.
That's right. That's the North Star. And it's pretty simple, frankly, at this point. We can get in the weeds on all the things and all the policies, but it's going to come down to this. My friend Sharon McMahon, who leads a large community of invested citizens, really. She also says, democracy above party. Thank you so much for being here. I'm just following you and listening and cheering for you in every possible way. And people who want to read your book, which is such an incredible gift, they can get it anywhere books are sold.
Yes, they can get it. But choose an indie bookstore if you can, because we want to support that. We want to keep the indie bookstores alive.
Big yes, big same. All right, you guys. Thank you, Joy. Great to meet you.
Great to meet you.
Like, what did I tell you? What did I tell you? I'm not going to just throw a question to her and she can just speak knowledgeably about it nonstop without a break or a breath endlessly. I love smart, interesting women and she's at the top of the pile. I am with her. I'm with her on everything she said. I think this year, I particularly mean women that I hope you heard her say, women outpace men in every demographic when it comes to voting. We are the majority voter. And therefore, we have not just the responsibility, but the opportunity to turn the tides. Just us, even if we don't even convince any of the men. If just the women say, we are going to vote for freedom and democracy. We have that power, and this is our year to galvanize and mobilize and cherish those ideals above all else. So I'm going to put links over at jenhatmaker.com under the podcast tab. It'll have this episode if you'd like to share it. This is a good sharer. This is a really good sharer. We have the video of this interview over on my YouTube channel if you'd like to watch us have this conversation. And then I'll have links to all of Joy's books, including her latest book about Medgar and Merlee and everywhere that you can get it. And so thank you for being a part of this important conversation. We don't get to sit this one out. We just simply cannot. So wherever we live, whatever background we come from, and however we have identified thus far, it's all hands on deck this year. And so thank you for being a part of this really important conversation. And thank you to Joy Reid, who is just as brilliant and wonderful as expected. All right, you guys, new series starts next week. And don't miss it. If you haven't already subscribed to the show, do it. And you'll never skip an episode. All right. Love you guys. See you next week.
Before the Love podcast with Jen Hatmaker is a presentation of Odyssey and produced by Four Eyes Media, with Laura Neitzling, producer, Abby Stevens, production director, Gregory DiMario, production assistant, and Lauren Winfield, researcher. Odyssey's executive producers are Jenna Weiss-Berman and Leah Reese-Dennis. Special thanks to the team at Odyssey, Maura Curran, Melissa Wester, Matt Casey, Kate Hutchinson, Eric Donnelly, Aaron Constantino, Kurt Courtney, and Hilary Schupf. Listen and follow For the Love, an Odyssey podcast produced by Four Eyes Media on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a production of Four Eyes Media.